few of you at the previous Vital Action meeting that we had, and then maybe a few more of you out in Denver. For those who don't know, I'm a physical therapist. I'm living up in Syracuse, New York right now. And a project that I've had for the last year has been working on, like Stephanie said, rhabdo and how do we recover after experiencing rhabdo? Because before jumping into the FAOD community, my experience with rhabdo was limited to the more medical side. I'll see patients who have more severe rhabdo from chemotherapy, from different traumas they might experience. I just had a patient today with a severe medical complication induced rhabdo. So this was a project that I was inspired to do after I was invited to the first Mito Action meeting. And the big question on everyone's mind that they shared with me was, well, how do I get back to activity? And at the time I could think of what I would personally recommend, but in all honesty, I was like, is this the best evidence-based practice? Is this what the research says? I don't know, so let's find out the answer. The protocol that I'm going to share with you tonight is the result of a very, very extensive literature search of some, I think it ended up just shy of 10,000 articles. And then I went through them all and summarized them and tried to take the best bits out to form what we have right now. But as I said in Denver, this is a living document. I know this is not the final stage. So really, I want it to eventually be shaped into the best it can be. So please take a look at what I have so far, share with me your experiences and see what we can add to it to make it even better.
Great. So who in here feels comfortable maybe sharing some of their experiences with rhabdo? You can feel free to raise your hand, and then after one person goes, the next person can raise their hand. Go for it, Katie. And maybe also just say what FAOD you have. That might be helpful too.
Sure. Sorry. First of all, I'm really sorry about the state of me. It's after midnight here and we just had a family party. So I'm in my jammies. So excuse how I look. I'm from over in Ireland. I have L-CHAD. So I've had quite bad rhabdo in the past, like to the point where it, like, one hospital stint took me, like, honestly, like a good 6 months to learn to walk again. And we would have, like, just to give a background, I'm not sure what it's like in the States, but we would not have easy access to, like, physiotherapy here. Like, I've spent a couple of weeks in the high dependency unit, and you wouldn't see physiotherapy even there. And when I had this, the crisis that caused the really bad rhabdo, I didn't even go to HDU or ICU. So, like, I'm coming from a place where we wouldn't have easy access to physiotherapy unless we saw them privately. What worked for me, just so I had kind of the classic presentation of bad rhabdo with very high CKs, and I came out with essentially like little to no muscle tone in my legs for a couple of months. And particularly, like, the symptom that really lasted the longest was like the further down my limbs, so basically around my ankles and my feet. And to this day, like 9 years later after that crisis, I still have persistent numbness on, like, the outside of one of my feet, right up along my lower leg on the external left side. It was very challenging. That I started off walking, but I'll say this just to get it out of the way. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name of the physical therapist host. I'm really sorry because I logged in late.
That's okay. Sorry, my name is Pamela.
Pamela, sorry. I should have remembered it, but I'm terrible with names, so I know I read it. But Pamela, just I'll say it before I forget. I don't know if you have an equivalent over there, but we have, my background is in nutrition. So I actually rehabbed myself really by learning about sarcopenia, as I'm sure you would know about this in the elderly, because they have progressive loss of skeletal muscle. And so we have an equivalent kind of guidelines over here called the European Working Group on Sarcopenia in older adults. It's shortened to EWGSOP, OOGSOP. I can send a link to you. But basically, I was reading a lot of their work and a lot of their rehab exercises, and it really starts off with very basic stuff about walking, sitting and standing. And that was honestly very difficult for the first couple of months when I was rehabbing. It was just like read, and I was very fit going into the metabolic crisis. I would be quite an active L-chatter, and it was like an extreme. I was only in the hospital for about a week. And it was like really profound loss of muscle mass and muscle tone. And it took me a long time to get it back. But I really used the kind of sarcopenia based papers to rehab me. So lots of walking, slow build up of walking, like walking to the end of my road and back again for a couple of weeks, then taking a little bit more, then kind of setting a target for, say, 2000 steps, keeping it like that for about a month, then a little bit slower. And then once I got the walking down, the only other exercise that I personally did, and it helped a lot, and I'm sorry, this might not be super accessible to people, but it's a little bit more accessible here in Ireland, is Pilates. So I went and I saw someone privately initially just to do one-on-ones. She did specifically reformer Pilates. So just to explain, everyone's probably heard of Pilates where you're kind of on a mat, it looks a bit like yoga, but reformer Pilates, you're on a kind of a weird looking carriage, and it basically allows you to use resistance straps in your arms and your legs. So it provides you a lot more support, and it provides you really, you can tailor the resistance a lot. And you also don't have to worry about balance issues as you would say trying to balance on a mat and kind of yoga type poses. So I moved to that for a couple of months. And then again, a long process, I moved off the one-to-one lessons after maybe six lessons. I actually did really well based off that. And that really helped restore like the weakness in my ankles. So it was a lot easier to kind of walk and kind of walk at longer periods with that. And then after that, I moved to kind of group reformer Pilates classes. And I had a teacher who was very big on ankle work and leg strengthening and core strengthening and stuff. So that was basically what rehabbed me. It was a kind of a combination of sarcopenia literature and then the reformer Pilates.
It's actually really interesting to me because we use those in the physical therapy clinic that I work in now. And it's one of my favorite pieces of equipment because you can target so many muscles and you can get a good whole body workout in a supported position. It's a really great tool to have. Did you ever feel like you had any restrictions in your movement? Like you could only raise your arm to a certain height or things like that? Or was it just your ankles? Like you had trouble lifting your feet up?
Well, I mean, like when I came out of hospital, I literally was saying to them, I don't want to leave hospital because my legs were like trunks. I actually couldn't move my legs properly. So, putting aside that, because I kind of didn't go into exercise for a couple of weeks after I got home, in terms of the reformer, like I still would have like significant restrictions in squatting, lunging. So I can only do squatting and lunging with assistance. So I have to hold on to a bar. So I can't go down very far. Now, I'm not sure whether that, you know, this like this common thing, it's a common thing in L-chatters anyway, where we get very tight calves, like very tight calf muscles. Like, I'm not sure what, like I never did sports in school. So I'm not sure whether like with me, it's a combination of just never really using the muscles and I spend a lot of time sitting. So maybe they're a bit tighter, but I do think once you kind of have a bad case of rhabdo and you damage the muscles in your legs, I think it probably heals up too tightly. But and then there's obviously the combination of the neuropathy. But anyway, to this day, I would still not be able to do anything other than assisted lunges and squats. And I would not be able to go down very far. But I still like I would have good leg strength. Like I can do I can work up to 80 or 90 kilograms with leg press, for example. But I still can't do like not now. But when I was at my fittest, like say about 2 years ago, pre-pandemic. But still, even at that point, could not even remotely do anything other than assisted lunges and squats. I just can't go down that far. And the tightness is all in my calves and around my ankles, particularly my calves, because my reformer Pilates teacher and my gym instructor who I went to for weight training after a couple of years both said that the problems are in my kind of lower limb calf areas. So that's the big restrictions. I don't remember having any restrictions with my arms. I do think probably the weakest part of me is my upper body and like my back muscles, but I to be honest, it's probably just to do with me not using them throughout my whole life. I don't think it's to do with LCHAD per se. I definitely think the lower limbs, the calves, the ankles, the kind of the sides of the feet, and the kind of the lack of feeling that I have there really affects balance and the kind of proprioception and all those kind of things that you need to have to do certain certain movements. So yeah, just in short, just the lower limbs, but certainly the lower limbs, there is still persistent restrictions, and I don't think that they're going to get better.
I'm sorry if you already said, but about how long ago was this?
The rupture that caused all of this was in 2014. I haven't actually had a big crisis since then. So I've had CKs of 9,000 in 2000, but they were just little kind of stomach blips. This is where the bad injuries happened. That was back in 2014 when I had CKs of, I think, 40,000, I think. So yeah, it's been a long time. Basically where I'm at now, like, put it this way, like I think I'd reach like the max point of my kind of rebuilding strength within probably 2 years of me starting my exercise. And I was probably slower because I was doing it all myself. I think you could probably get to kind of like a good baseline a bit quicker with help, but I don't think, like, I've personally not seen, I didn't see any improvement after those 2 years. So it kind of got a little bit like fairly close to like my previous baseline, but not like, certainly not the way I was before, and it hasn't gotten worse since then, but it hasn't gotten better despite kind of persisting with the kind of fitness and the exercise and the rehab.
And I know you said after you first had rhabdo that you had trouble getting a physio when you were in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Have you had physical therapy since then, or no?
No, not for, never for the rhabdo. Like, do you mean in hospital or just generally?
Generally, like, I don't know how it goes in Ireland, but do they do outpatient like tune-ups for patients, or is it,
so they follow you? Yeah, they do. They do have, like, so we have a public system and a private system, basically, so you can kind of access both. Like, you don't have a hope in hell, excuse my language, of getting near a public system we call it physiotherapy. Sorry if I keep saying it, not physical. We say physio. So I'll just probably keep saying that out of habit. But like, there is literally like a 2 or 3 year waiting list to see a public physiotherapist on the public system. So you don't get a look in from an outpatient. Like, once you're at home, like, you're pretty much not going to see one unless you pay. So to be honest, just because I'd had experience before my rhabdo doing Pilates, I just went back to Pilates and I knew that that worked for me. I didn't have experience ever seeing physio in my memory. And I haven't seen one since for like PN or anything like that, or peripheral neuropathy, or for rhabdo. I just stuck with the Pilates, and then a couple of years later I did strength training, but that wasn't like, I was better by then, really. That was just for building up strength, kind of more from like an aesthetic kind of strength point of view, not really functional. I will say though, before I forget, when I was a baby, because I remember from your talk during the Mito Action Conference, I remember as a baby, my mom was telling me that, because I think generally there's more resources in pediatric hospitals here. So I think they might have, I'm not 100% sure, I think they might have a physiotherapist assigned to metabolics in the pediatric hospital. Not sure if they have it still now, but I think they do. But I do know that my mom was telling me that when I was a baby, they would bring me regularly to see physio in the hospital. And they had to terminate it because this is when I would be quite sick. This was like very early 90s, like 1991, 1992, when they didn't know anything about LCHAD. And so I think my CKs would have been very high. I would have had heart failure and all. I would have been quite sick. And I know that they actually had to terminate the physical therapy at that time because the movements were actually causing me so much stress. Like, I would cry throughout the whole thing. So I don't remember any of that now because I was too young. But yeah, we just don't have access to physical therapy really out in the community unless you see them privately.
Do you remember when you were in the hospital if they gave you any recommendations? Like, they said, okay, your CK levels are now below 10,000, you can do X, Y, and Z, or did they just say, okay, you're medically clear, you're discharged, just take it easy, go slow?
No, I mean, in 2014, I was just told to go home and eat carbohydrates, which was like not useful at all, because actually I should have said this before, but what I did was I got kind of in line with me reading about the sarcopenia. I just looked at my diet. We would not have a lot of resources available to us in Ireland, so I'm doing a lot of this myself. But I would have looked at like my protein intake, and I would have been what, 24 at the time. So I remember making a conscious effort of trying to get about a gram of protein per kilogram of body weight in around that time. So I expect that my protein might have been a bit lower. It probably was about 0.6 to 0.8, because I think that's what they had me on at the time. But so I increased my protein a little bit, and that I do think that actually, like, for obvious reasons, I think that would have helped. Obviously being a bit careful with it, but like I figured that out by myself. I was just told to go home and eat carbohydrates back in 2014. And then I actually found in this year, when I've gone into hospital this year, I've had a couple of surgeries. They are very big in the ERAS, you know, the enhanced recovery after surgery protocol, where they like drag you out of bed right after surgeries. But they're people who really wouldn't be familiar with the fact that I've got LCHAD. They're just general nurses trying to hold you out of bed when you're kind of post-op to prevent ileus and that kind of thing. So there's really nothing from the metabolic team, particularly nothing, like no actual recommendations to walk. I actually was in having surgery earlier this year, and I was actually told that I shouldn't be active, even though my CKs were normal. And I actually fought to have a break to actually be going off and do a walk without my drip for 45 minutes a day, because I find that if I go from doing like my usual, say, walk of about a half an hour a day in a very short amount of time, if I were to say like, if I were to have like a week in bed, I would become very hypotonic in my legs. Like I wouldn't be in pain or anything like that. I might be able to get it back within a week or two, but it's surprising to me like how quickly I can become hypotonic just by the lack of use of the muscles. So really like we don't have any programs here on recommendations from the metabolic side or the general ward side in encouraging movement. You really only see that from an enhanced recovery after surgery point of view from specialist nurses down in ICU and HDU. So yeah, and to be honest, I'm not sure now, just from my own subjective point of view, I'm not sure if my CKs were above 5,000, if I would really be able or willing to do exercises in hospital. Like I think once I was like a couple of days before going home, like if they were maybe 5,000 or below, and if I wasn't in pain, then that would be okay. But like from memory, like once, because I really like the one pain that I do get when I rhabdo is leg pain. It's leg pain or the back of my neck, and it's very severe. So like you'd really want the pain to be gone and for you to just be left with the weakness before you do anything, because like it's just like the pain is just so bad you can't really breathe through it. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's probably coming from that too. Like I think the metabolic team are just so used to people being in pain that they just have never even conceived of the idea of making a protocol where you recommend it. And then that confounded with the fact that just over here we don't have the availability of physiotherapists in the hospital. Like they are there. We do have physiotherapists in the hospital, but they're not rated to adult metabolic services, because even in our national service, in our hospital for adults, we actually don't even have a ward. And we technically don't even have assigned beds. We have assigned beds. We have three beds in the whole hospital, and we only get them if they're not taken by other people. So it's a really bad service in Ireland. But just kind of take that for what it's worth. Like I'm coming from a place of really, really low resources, and hopefully like your guidelines will be able to be used in places with better resources. But yeah, I've come across a team that would really be like quite anti giving advice about movement.
My hope with this was to make something that was patient friendly enough that it could just be shared. And then worst comes to worst, if you don't have access to a physical therapist, or they just discharge you and you aren't set up and you don't have that resource, it could be followed through without guidance. Ideally, like obviously I'm a physical therapist, I advocate for physical therapy and I believe in it strongly, but that was my hope with making it, because there are a bunch of protocols out there and some of them ended up being very complicated. So thank you for sharing. My hope is that I've pared this down enough, so please let me know if it reads friendly enough that if you were back in 2014 And in that situation, you feel like you could have followed along with it, or if I need to look at the language again and revise how I wrote it.
So did you send that? Have you shared that in the email? Did I miss it?
Stephanie, I don't believe it's shared in the email, but I do have it pulled up and I was planning on going through it with everyone.
Well, that's fine. Well, that's perfect. No, sorry. I thought I'd miss something, but it was a hectic weekend with birthdays. Like, oh God, did you share it? And did I not read it? But that's fine. I will definitely read through it and I'll give feedback. I'm sure it's very good.
With emailing it to everyone. In fact, right now I can put in, I'm just thinking for a moment. Like I mentioned, I was about to put in my current work email, but I am only going to be here for maybe one more year before I move to Pittsburgh. So I'll give everyone my private email. So if you ever want to just connect, or if you'd like to ask to see the protocol, just send me an email here. I'll also, I'm on WhatsApp. That's a little more friendly, I think, for international chats, but I can give you my private number and my WhatsApp too.
Yeah, it would be a huge job. It was very interesting. It really was, like, it really is something that's, it's very it's very jarring when you have a bad rhabdo event. Like, I was particularly kind of shooting in the dark because I didn't have a memory of having rhabdo for a long time. I think I had a rhabdo when I was 4 or 5. So I had no memory of it, but like, it is very scary, the idea of getting back into moving, because you're so scared about going into rhabdo again. It's a great thing to actually be able to, like, to have someone developing a protocol for recovery, because I think probably without it, you get a service like where I'm at, where they kind of treat you like with cotton gloves the whole time and they just don't want you to move. And, you know, I think, because I know there's two L chatters where I am and I'm quite active, but I know the other person with L chat is like really, really poor mobility. I think they need assistance to mobilize. I think there's, you know, you could be circulating it to people who have a very limited amount of patients, and so, like, there might not, I mean, there's technically could be quite a lot of heterogeneity between the patients, but if they have a couple of patients who've done very poorly, I think that might be informing their fear of the patients moving or rehabbing or, quote, doing anything that's different. That's a big thing that I found over in Ireland. They're very scared of doing things that are different or rocking the boat. So I think it would, like, but they are very receptive of the American experts, and so I think they'll receive it for sure when it comes out. Very exciting.
Thanks so much, Katie. I see we have Alex and Jean's hand up too. So Alex, do you want to go? And then Jean, do you want to go next?
Sure. So I'm Alex. I have L-CHAD. Me and Pam are well acquainted. I had been doing PT and OT regimen 3 days a week prior to the COVID pandemic. And then everything shut down. I turned 18 and I tried to resume the same PT regimen after the pandemic, but my endurance was much less, and that caused my first rhabdo episode. So that is how I was introduced to rhabdo. I'd done the PT for weakness and neuropathy, and my rhabdo episodes are coupled with the rhabdo breakdown and the weakness. And so some of my hospitalizations have been up to 3 weeks long. I've lost the ability to walk for most of them. And so it's very difficult to try and figure out, being sedentary for multiple weeks in a hospital bed, how to, you know, then do physical therapy. And some of the things I've done is stretching and getting up for short walks as my numbers are coming down, and when that pain leaves, because they, you know, with those muscle fibers and stuff, they try not to get me to do too much, you know, when they're still very strained and stressed. And then ultimately, once I feel recovered and those numbers have gone down, I can resume the one therapy a week I do now. Yeah. I don't know where my rhabdo is.
And Alex, did you get PT in the hospital? Did they come and help you walk? Did they stretch you? Did they do anything?
I've had you know, PT in the past, but with the rhabdo, most PTs, even in the hospital, they'll be like, okay, rhabdo, we're not going to exercise you because your muscles are breaking down type perspective. So the doctors won't even like put a referral in because they're like, well, you could just stretch on your own. They won't really work you because you're in rhabdo.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is something that I feel like I've stumbled across. And in general, I think the perspective on rhabdo is still very young. It's almost like going back and looking at the perspectives that we had back in like the 50s and the 60s of, oh, okay, we just gave this person back surgery. They need to be on traction for 3 weeks and you can't move them at all. And now you'll have someone have back surgery and immediately that same day, okay, you're going to work with physical therapy, you're going to do X, Y, and Z. It's like, it just hasn't quite caught up with what we know is out there just yet. So I will say, at least in the US, my perspective has been limited to just the country that I live in. You always have the right to request a script for physical therapy. And also when the physical therapist comes in, you always have the right to say, now is not a great day. I am still in a lot of pain. You can always say, can we just do some gentle things in bed? I saw a patient just today who has rhabdo from a lot of medical complications and he couldn't get up. So you modify what you do and maybe it's a shorter time, maybe it's less intense, maybe it's longer rest breaks, maybe it's a less range. Just know, like I said, within the US, that is within your right to ask for that referral to see what you can do and maintain what you have so that you don't get as tight later, so you keep the strength that you have. That's the my little bit of advice to share.
Jean, did you want to share something?
Hi, I'm Jean, and I'm a beginner. I have MCAD, and I just found out, like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, I met Stephanie, right? I got my genetic testing back, and yep, I'm a member. So I don't know if I've had actual rhabdo, but I can't walk very well. I started the, I carry around my phone and I was walking like 150 steps a day. And that was like the max. So I could get from the bed or the TV room to the bathroom and that's like it. So, and maybe take a shower. So now I'm taking level carnitine and I can get up to like 400 steps a day. So, what do I do to get stronger? Cause I had a physical therapist come to the house before I knew I had MCAD and she almost killed me. It was like, I couldn't do any of that. I was so exhausted. So what do I look for? Like, this is such a rare disease. I don't know who to contact for help in giving me correct exercise. Like, I joined a thing with an MS physical therapist, like, who does like group classes, and maybe I could just do it on my own, like watch the videos. I just kind of feel lost, and I just know I can't walk. I can't really leave the house. I'm 52 and it's been, you know, 15 months of it. And my doctors just kind of go, So do you have any ideas?
I would say that
a therapist,
unfortunately, there isn't a lot of evidence out there right now. I'm hoping that as time goes on and hopefully eventually this protocol gets published, that just spurs more conversation, more publications as we come up with better things and interventions to use. If you have a physical therapist and are working with them, I would encourage you to use words like, think of me like I'm a patient with MS, or think of me as a patient with Guillain-Barré syndrome.
MS or Guillain-Barré. So someone with those kind of experiences would be the way to go.
So if you're in the US, and sorry, once again, this is my bias.
I am.
You would look for a therapist who has gone a step further. So our clinical education, we get a doctorate. It will be a DPT after our name. Mm-hmm. But after that, if they have some additional letters, like for instance, if they have an NCS, that means they are a neurological clinical specialist.
Okay.
So they've gone a step further. They've done research. They've done a certain number of clinical hours. They maybe have done some sort of dissertation. They've also taken a 8-hour board exam.
Okay.
On further specialization on those specific conditions. And no, they won't be specific to metabolic conditions. But if you can get them in the ballpark of thinking, think of me like a patient with Guillain-Barré, okay. I already know off the bat, okay, I need to do certain intervals. I can't over fatigue you. Like that mm-hmm. sets up your session. So we're not over exhausting you.
Right. Cause I couldn't do anything that with this woman wanted me to do. It was like, yeah. Yeah. And then I have a lot of, like, you know, my legs used to be kind of chubby and now they're skinny. So I, you know, that's not good. Okay. So basically I just got to find somebody or do something online with, cause I can't leave the house, with someone with neurological Guillain-Barré, maybe MS training.
Yes. I will say, folks on the younger side, if you could find a physical therapist who has a PCS, that is a pediatric certified specialist, they will have training both on the neurological side and the orthopedic side. Okay. If you fail at finding a therapist in your area with those, mm-hmm. if you can get someone who has an OCS, that is an ortho certified specialist, they will learn a lot of like hip and knee and shoulder injuries, but they also get special training in rhabdo.
Okay.
In addition to that, if they have a CSCS, certified sports conditioning specialist,
okay.
they should have a little better training on building a specific program tailored to you. That would be my ranking, I would say. I would look for someone with a pediatric certified specialist or a neuro certified specialist first. If you fail to find that, then you could look for someone who has their ortho certified specialist. If you fail at that, the CSCS.
Would you say that even though I don't know if I've had a rhabdo episode, I've gone to the emergency room with these like, you know, passing out weakness thing, and they just kind of gave me an EKG and sent me on my way, and I laid in bed moaning for a week. You know, these doctors have been zeros. Would you say that I did have rhabdo at some point, or I just got weak?
Hard to say retroactively, but definitely within the realm of possibility.
Okay, it's possible. Okay.
If I saw you, I would tend towards the side of caution and assume that yes, you probably did experience rhabdo, and then
okay.
what we did off of that.
Okay, awesome. Very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and I can put those abbreviations in the chat too for.
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah.
I know it's a lot of.
I was writing them down, but put them in the chat.
Us medical people, we love our letters.
Yeah, awesome.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Just if it helps, because I like I've talked about rhabdo with like the other older Alexanders that I know, and like we actually all describe what the pain is like in like freakishly similar ways, where it's like we all describe it as some variant of it's like your bones are on fire. Like it's a really, really unique pain. It wouldn't be like it's not like, say, if you were to go to a gym or go for a walk and you're like, do you know, have you ever like, some people like if you ever go to a gym or like, you remember from when you were younger where you do a heavy exercise or workout and then a day or two later, it's hard to go up and down the stairs or sit in the toilet because your muscles are sore from the exercise. You know, that kind of deep kind of more pulsating, kind of achy pain that you get.
Well, I have neuropathy, really bad neuropathy at times, and my just legs feel like cement. Like I just can't move them. They're almost like not connected sometimes.
That's like, yeah, that's kind of like the deconditioning like I would have gotten after rhabdo. But rhabdo, like active rhabdo for me and from the other patients that I've spoken to, it's like active rhabdo is like a searing pain.
Yeah,
right where your bones are, usually in your legs and usually starts in your legs, but it can be other places as well. But I think the key things are just like get a protocol that checks for CK. They should be able to tell you if you're in rhabdo, but yeah, be But yeah, it's, if that helps identify it, like we all seem to describe the pain of active rhabdo quite similarly or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
That is something that I'm trying to work on right now with Dr. Buckley. We have a test unit that we're trying to propose to the US military, because if you can get things funded by the military first, it tends to go much easier in the US, of monitoring CK on your own at home. This is all very pending.
That would be like the dream if we could do that.
There's no timeline at the moment, but I was just in a meeting this past week where we floated the idea to the military, and they're very interested. So there'll be more to come.
Because don't they kind of go in, sometimes they can go into that acute rhabdo from like doing too many burpees and push-ups and those kind of intensive exercises. Yeah.
Yes. Actually, it's very concerning how many men the military have given rhabdo to.
Yeah. Because I remember because it's hard for people to, I was going to Pilates people and gym, subsequently then gym instructors. And I'm small and I look kind of like to other people, like to big kind of weightlifters and powerlifters who are trainers, I look kind of like the deconditioned kind of like skinny fat type person and I was always getting people who'd be like, oh yeah, we'll bring you in and we'll let you do like mountain climbers. And I was like, no. And like, it was just like, it was so difficult for me to explain it. And I found a really good guy who was like what we call a real dub. So he's like a real Dubliner, like a real Dublin accent. And he immediately got it because he was a power lifter. And I actually found that I actually had quite good success with people who had, if I was doing specifically just weight training, this is like a couple of years after rehab, but if you wanted to do weight training, like, and you, for whatever reason, you couldn't access a physical therapist. But like a way to describe it would be like, the way he said it was, gotcha, you need to be anabolic, not catabolic. And that was just like a really simple way of him understanding. So he's like, he understood that like, she is really, really delicate. She'll go into rhabdo and become really, really sick. So he just understood as like, right, everything needs to be really, really gentle about building you up. And we can't push you to the point of like, obviously you can't really get anabolic and do exercise without having some degree of catabolism as well. But like he really got that you needed to just like focus on the anabolism and not the catabolic part of it. But like, yeah, I think, it is a very delicate balance, especially like as Alex said, because you can really like go into rhabdo quite quickly if you overexert yourself, and like your baseline can be so variable. You know, like some days you can be really, really tired and not know it until you actually try to do exercise. And other days you can have a really good tolerance. So it is, I think, tricky for practitioners to take us on.
Katie, do you remember when you started going back to exercise, did you shoot for a certain number of sets or reps with the Pilates instructor? Was it?
I could probably go back and ask. I mean, like I'm good friends with the trainer I was with a long time. So I'll start with just the walking. So the walking would have literally just been to my end of my road. So that would, because that like literally would have been all I was able to do. And for the first couple of weeks after I got home, probably a couple of months after I got home, probably maybe 3 months, my feet, like even when I was able to kind of walk a bit more, my feet would just collapse out because I think the nerves were regenerating around my feet. And like, obviously they didn't come back fully in the side of one of my feet, for example. But my feet would just collapse out. Like I wouldn't be fatigued. I wouldn't be tired. They would just collapse out and I would not be able to walk for like an hour or 2 hours. So you're contending with the nerves regenerating as well. So my first goal would have been just walk to the end of my road, which would have been, crap with distances now, but not that far, just the end of my road. I don't live in a big estate or anything like that. And then I have a park near me, just probably, I can send you the distances actually. I don't know if off the top of my head, but it's probably I would have worked up within about 6 months to a couple of kilometers. But it was really slow. Like I definitely did steps and I focused on it with steps. So it would have been maybe like 200 would have exhausted me initially. Then within a couple of months, I would have got to 1,000. And then a big landmark for me would have been 3,000, because that would have been to the park and back, not going into the park or around the park. And then I wanted to go in the park, but only halfway. So that would have taken me like another 1,000. So I was kind of going up in increments of about 1,000 after a while. And then once I was able to get to like the big one where I kind of stopped, because I was like, the end of my goal was 7,000. And that took a year for me to do that. Like, that's obviously a lot. And so I was very lucky to be able to do it. But like, it, when I say it took like a long time to do that of every day, and I also wasn't working at the time and I was out of college. So I had the time to do it, which is also like not really feasible for a lot of people. And, you know, it was like all these kind of things make a difference. Like, it wasn't really uphill or downhill. Like, it was fairly flat land, you know, all these things matter, especially like little things where if you're dealing with like a bit of neuropathy post-rhabdo in your feet, if you're walking on a road that's like a pavement or a sidewalk that's slightly tilted, or if it's got like a little bit of like a dip in it, like in the cement or something. But like with nerve damage in your feet, particularly, like, you can be slightly at a slant and it can feel like it'll send a signal to your brain like you're falling off a cliff, and you can actually kind of almost fall. They're like, it's very debilitating to try to rehab after rhabdo with your peripheries when it's damaged. So it's really, really slow. I definitely did steps, and I definitely went up like maybe like a couple of hundred initially, and then once I got to 1,000, pretty sure I was moving up in terms of like goals of 1,000, but like, bear in mind, it did take like a year to get up to 7,000. And then I was never really able to do more than 7,000 in one go, but I would then be able to come home, rest for a couple of hours, and then sometimes I would go out for another walk in the evenings, and that would bring me up to close to 10,000. But that would be when I was very, like, very fit, maybe a year and a half or so afterwards. And I'm not at that point now. Like, I'd be able to do 6,000 or 7,000 now. To be honest, my legs probably wouldn't get fatigued. It would be just be like a kind of a general like lung capacity kind of fatigue from post COVID being locked in. But yeah, I think setting steps targets is the best thing, because everyone can do that now. You know, like in 2014, you kind of just were at the point where you could use it on your phone. But like, everyone can do that now. So I think steps is a really good, helpful way of doing it.
When they had you on the Pilates reformer, did they say, okay, you're going to do this exercise for 10 reps, take a rest, do another set of 10? Or did they say you're doing 8, 6? Do you know? Oh, Katie, I think you're muted.
Mute. Sorry, I must have hit something. Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah, what I might do, Pam, to help you out is I'll email my Pilates instructor to see if she remembers. But it would have been, she watched me the whole time, and I, for example, would have been like initially really, really fatigued on, I'm going to say, my legs. So she might do like I can't remember now. It was like some like the lighter weights, I could do maybe 10 reps of one, 4 sets. But then if it was like slightly heavier, it might only be 3 sets of 4 reps or something. Like, everything was just about bringing me to the point where I was starting to like to get fatigued, where like I'd have to like get to the point where my legs were kind of like shaking, but not to the point where I was out of breath or really struggling, because then they'd stop. Or obviously if I was in pain, they wouldn't, like, I would stop. But like, they were very much kind of being guided by, like, I think realistically just watching for signs of fatigue. Because like my even now, like, if I put my legs up, and if I were to keep them up, I've got pretty good leg strength, but like if I were to put my legs up in the air, my legs will shake, which I think is just like a autonomic kind of neuropathy kind of thing that's just lasting. So but that's kind of like my normal baseline. But, you know, like I did notice that for Pilates and for the strength training, they were watching me really, really closely, and they had the training. I obviously wouldn't, but like, they would have the training to know what's the safe amount of fatigue and the safe amount of shaking. And they would kind of intuitively know. And they would also, they would just listen to me if I felt like it was too much.
Thank you. Dana, I think you've had your hand up for a while. Do you have a story to share or any questions at all?
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm late to the meeting, but I would just share my story, and I only have a few minutes. Actually, I have to leave for an event in a bit. So I'm 56. My onset was at about age 14. Was not diagnosed as any, well, rhabdo for sure. So high school, college, I probably experienced rhabdo once every 2 weeks. So I didn't really realize what was going on, and it would I would essentially suffer through it, and in 2 to 3 days I would be better. just obviously not understanding what was going on. But when I was 30, I was diagnosed with CPT2. Had a little bit more understanding and direction of what might be going on, but still not that great. And then actually I was diagnosed VLCAD in the last 10 years from a genetic test. So that one now is conclusive. I have a really great metabolic specialist now who is very helpful and has encouraged me in the last 5 to 6 years that I'm obviously older and well, smarter with what I do. And I probably have mild rhabdo experiences, maybe, I don't know, 4 times a year and maybe one really bad one a year. And she has pushed me to go into the ER with my letter to make sure they put me on a D10 drip right away. Sometimes they do it. Sometimes it takes a while. And I frankly... it's both wonderful and, you know, and hard to hear everyone's stories. I usually recover within 2, 3, maybe 4 days, depending on the event. But what things that I do even during, you know, I've heard someone talking about just keeping moving, and that's something that even though I'm in a lot of pain over the years, I know that if I keep moving during a rhabdo, just the slightest bit, it does help. Help what? What does it help? It helps it not get so bad, I think, or helps me recover faster. I'm not sure. Because I do know if I sit and do nothing when I'm experiencing rhabdo, as soon as I get up, it feels so much worse. I don't know if that feeds into anything.
Very helpful.
Yeah, I try to treat some at home and I've gotten a lot better. I typically eat pretty naturally, so I've avoided things, but she's convinced me to go on a Gatorade, high protein Gatorade, high water situation as soon as I feel rhabdo coming on. So, I keep Gatorade around now all the time, which is hilarious to my kids. And I find that helps me a lot too. And I seek foods that are high protein, low fat. I'm sold on Cliff Bars, the crunchy peanut butter ones, because they're both good. And that's my thing. If I feel it coming on, I reach for my Gatorade, my Cliff Bar, and a couple extra bottles of water. And I do what I can. But like I said, I do land in the ER about once a year. Now they do, again, back to the thing where they don't, you know, when they see those CK levels with someone walking and off the street, it completely freaks them out. Especially the last time I went, when they did not page the metabolic specialist on call like they're supposed to. And then actually one time they tried to keep me there like a second night. And I just was like, nope, I know how this goes. I know that I'm going to be better in 2 days. And they made me sign, you know, the whatever that leaving on my own consent or whatever that's called. Because they're, you know, I could feel my body was on its path to quote unquote recovering from that rhabdo. That's my story.
And do you usually direct your own recovery, or does therapy, or do any doctors get involved?
I'd say no doctors. It would be self-directed. And I try to make sure I keep moving enough so that I'm not completely motionless. And just, you know, just depending on the situation, I just come back as slowly as I can to my regular, you know, whatever my regular life is.
So that's actually very helpful. And Charmaine, I do want to get to you next. I will take a very quick second, and I would like to share my screen with you just because, Dana, I know you have to leave. So I'd like to show you the protocol as it stands right now. And like I said, I can send this out to you as well. Let's see. So I'm very glad that you said that a little bit of movement seems to help out, because that is actually what I have in that very first stage. So in my mind, I envision this first stage. You're in the hospital, you've been diagnosed with rhabdo. So these are the very first things that you do, and they're very, very gentle. You're just doing as you tolerate some movements, either with assistance or on your own against gravity, just kind of keeping everything fluid, keeping the strength in your muscle by doing some isometric holds. So that just means like turning the muscle on. Like if I wanted to show off my bicep, I would just flex for a few seconds and then let it relax. And that's essentially what you do in that first stage. And then once you are able to progress to that next stage, and I've highlighted in purple what I'm looking for. So essentially you can get against gravity movement of all your joints, and it's not triggering intense pain. Your CK levels are clear. Then you can move on to stage two, where you're starting to do maybe a little bit of aerobic activity. So this is that walking that Katie was talking about, maybe progressing your holds of those isometric exercises, starting some very gentle strength training. So strength training, there are a couple different ways to build strength. What I was aiming for initially was building endurance of the muscle before building any power. So to do that, you do lighter resistance, so around 25% of your rep max, and you're doing more repetitions. So you're trying to have that muscle fire for a longer period and be able to hold it for a good stabilization. The third stage, you're looking to gradually build up your strength, build up your endurance, and then we move on from there. But just based on the stories that we've heard so far, those first two stages, and I was happy to hear that it seems to kind of line up with people's experiences. I'm curious what you all think now that you see it, if this would be something that you could follow through when you're in the hospital, if it is confusing at all. Feel free to share your thoughts, but Charmaine, I know you've been very patiently waiting for a while, so let me stop sharing my screen for a second and give you the stage.
Well, I just wanted to jump in to say, well, I'm 41. I was diagnosed in 2015, but had my first rhabdo episode in 2014. So I'm diagnosed with CPT2. So I live in Canada. So some of my experiences and stuff may be a little bit different than the States or Ireland, but just for them talking about Pilates, that's what I got into. And that's what I felt helped a lot was, and then I was originally doing mat Pilates, and in my area, I kind of found my own people to work with. The hospital I was, when I was admitted to the hospital, they did give me somebody for physio that was part of the rehab center at our hospital in Nova Scotia, but I found people just didn't know. People didn't know what rhabdo was. They just didn't know how to help me. I just felt like I was on my own. Anyway, just the timing and the difference and stuff, and it was provided free for me. And I did get a genetic counselor, but it would be almost, that's why it took so long for diagnosis. By the time I got to see them and got them to do the blood work, it was almost 2 years later. So I basically had to figure everything out on my own in those first kind of like year and a half before I was even diagnosed to even know what I had. They just told me I had a rhabdo episode. They just said it was from doing too much activity, because I was doing boot camp, but I didn't feel like it was anything out of the normal of why wouldn't people do that. And anyway, but once I got my diagnosis, everything made sense throughout my life of stuff that had happened, but it was just kind of interesting. So anyway, I have my own specialist team. I see a naturopath. I have a physiotherapist that I just see right now. It's just kind of maintaining. I just see them just to have someone, because I also don't have a family doctor. We have a very big shortage of family doctors, I think in all of Canada, but especially Nova Scotia. So I don't have a family doctor. So basically it's up to me. I'm very lucky. I'm a teacher. So I do have some benefits, medical benefits. So well, I at least have some portion of all the specialists that I see, you know, kind of paid for. I do pay a lot of money every year to see. I have a naturopath, physiotherapist. I see a chiropractor, an acupuncturist, lots of stuff to try and help me get back to dealing with my health. Plus, so I was seeing a physiotherapist and I was doing physio Pilates. So that was on the mat. And then her classes, she wasn't going to run them in the evenings anymore. And I was working in the daytime. So that's when I kind of had to look for another physio place to go, or a Pilates place to go to. And I found one that has a reformer. So yeah, so it's made a huge difference in being able to use the reformer. I'm not really sure. I don't want to take up, because I know there's other people that are waiting to chat too, but I have no problem if you want to reach out later to kind of have a more in-depth thing. I think it's great that you're doing a protocol for CPT or for rhabdo, which to me, I think would help a lot of people who have CPT2 and any of the other genetic disorders.
Well, thank you. Did you feel like you ever, either with your Pilates instructor or on your own, targeted any goals with trying to build up your strength again?
So like
my thought was of targeting endurance first, and that's why I set the protocol for those lower intensity sets but higher repetitions, and then you gradually transition to higher intensity for lower reps.
Yeah, so my stuff, how I feel like when I do Pilates, is that I find we have to sometimes you might do stuff on one side of your body and they do two or three different movements. Oftentimes I can't do that. So she'll often, like my instructor and I have talked and we've done some one-on-one sessions too. I mostly do group just because it's a little bit cheaper. Usually she'll know I'll change sides and just do the same thing on the other side instead of, so like if I'm working on left side or right side, it's not necessarily so much tailored, to like work on specific things. However, she says, just because I'm a regular, she usually tries to tailor our group classes to stuff. But yeah, usually I find like I can only do a small amount of reps and I just feel like my muscles, they just like freeze. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's just like I can't do any more. So I stop, and if I rest, then I could go back and do that afterwards. So usually we'll focus on something else that's a little bit different and then go back to those things. So she tries to tailor her classes to that. So it's a little more movement of flipping and flopping on whatever side we're working on, but you know, it's just what we do. Like usually if we do a mat class, if we're working on our left leg and my fatigue's out, then I'll just go work on my right leg and then come back to the left leg later. I have learned doing Pilates that there's a lot of smaller muscles that after I had my major episode, like I couldn't move at all. It was so hard to go up and down the stairs in my house and just to like move, which is another big thing of like, I bought this new house and then I'm getting sick. And then it was like, we're stuck on one level just because it took so long to like get. And I mean, other people are saying 2 or 3 days to feel better. That's if I feel like, oh, I might be having a rhabdo episode, and I probably am. But the severe ones, like that one I had that I ended up in the hospital, I would say probably almost took me almost over a year and a half to even get back to doing anything. Like now I feel like almost 10 years later that, you know, oh, I can do 10,000 steps a day. Usually if I go beyond that, I need to start taking medication, you know, or upping my medication to be able to take. So I take L-carnitine and I usually do MCT oil a lot. You know, just like Dana, the protocol I always carry, you know, the extra water, you've got your protein bar, you've got, I don't do Gatorade. I resisted to them saying that. I do more coconut water or just other things that have electrolytes in them.
It's very interesting how everyone's experience can be different. Like I mentioned, my experience with rhabdo is definitely the more medically complicated side. So in generally, the patients I see, I try to forewarn them, this will be a long process. I anticipate 6 months. My goal is for you to be back to your function and hopefully back to your activities. A year is where I'm really looking for, okay, now you're feeling like you're maybe back to where you were. Chris, have you grown taller since I saw you? If so, please stop.
Probably, I probably have. Oh no. But my name's Chris. I'm 14. Yeah. I'm the son of Mito Action / Stephanie, and I have Elshad. And so I think that Miss Wilkie made like a good point about like repetition, like in the muscle, because like typically I find when I have like rhabdo and stuff, it stems from like hardcore repetition. So like say I come back from basketball, right, and I like do repetitive squats or like side to side shuffles, which really work hard on my legs. Like I found I have a ton of muscle tightness and pain, which isn't quite rhabdo yet, but it's like almost on the way there. So what I find that I need to do is I typically have like an Epsom salt bath, or I take, like she said, electrolytes or Gatorade, just so I get those fluids in. And that's one of the things I also use to, when I have rhabdo, to recover. I drink a lot of fluids and have a lot of Gatorade and calories, just because it really helps my muscles to recover. And then like afterwards, I go out and like gradually start to do exercises and stuff. Another example of like when I had repetitive exercise and it actually led to rhabdo was when I was pretty small and I was in Pennsylvania. It was around like winter time and I was going up and down this hill because it was like one of the only times I ever sled in my life, because I'm from Georgia, we don't ever get snow. And so I was going up, it was super cold, and the cold also played a factor too, I'm pretty sure, on my legs, but and just my energy expenditure as well. But I just repetitively went up and down that hill, and I think it had just a really hard time on my legs. And so as a result, I had rhabdo, and I went to the hospital. And so it's, I just really wanted to like make a point that the repetitive motion really has an effect like on how your legs move and stuff.
And that's definitely something that is supported in the literature. If I can warn anyone against a particular kind of exercise, I would say tread with caution with eccentric exercises. So how our muscles move, there's concentric, isometric, and eccentric movements. And how you can think of it is if the muscle is shortening, if it's staying in place, or if it's lengthening. So for instance, if I hold this glass and I bring it up, my muscle, my biceps is shortening. So you can see the muscle more. That's a concentric movement. If it just stays in place, if the muscle is just turned on, it's isometric. It doesn't change the distance that it moves. If I lower it from my mouth to the table, that's an eccentric movement. So those are like squats, lunges, running downhill. The literature definitely supports eccentric exercises as predisposing people to rhabdo. That's not to say never do a lunge or a squat ever again. It's more of a tread with caution. You see it more with people who try to suddenly jump into like marathon running, or if they join a CrossFit gym and they have to do a bunch of leg raises over and over. Just know your body, know your limits, listen to your body. If your muscles are starting to say, hey, I need a break, give it a break and know that eccentric demand on your muscles is really high.
Thank
you. Robin.
All right. So Chris, your story resonates so much with me. I'm like the old senior citizen in the group here. My first symptom, I have CPT too also, I was diagnosed at 40 years old, married, I'm a nurse. I had 3 children. And when I was diagnosed, the neurologist said, I'm going to register you at the Muscular Dystrophy Association. You have carnitine palmitoyl transfer ACE deficiency. And I literally thought I was going to die. I just sat there in the chair, and the only thing I knew about muscular dystrophy was Jerry Lewis telethon, and everybody was in a wheelchair. And I was working full-time as a nurse. I had been basically blown off by every doctor my whole entire life. They basically would say to me, oh, well, you know, you're under a lot of stress. You have 3 children. You have a full-time job. You're a little bit overweight. You have anxiety. I'm like, buddy, I don't have anxiety. I've got like this really bad muscle pain. And nobody ever said it's possible that you have a muscle disease. My first symptoms started after I climbed a mountain when I was 11 years old. I couldn't get down. My legs locked up. I had to slide on my butt all the way down. When I got down to the end of the mountain, I had black urine. My urine was the color of Coca-Cola, and nobody cared. They thought I was just dehydrated. So every time it happened to me, which would be every couple of years, I'd go on a hike for hunger. I'd do a dance marathon, any repetitive movement without like taking a break and not drinking fluids and not resting, I would get that pain in my back and my legs and my neck. And I'd say, uh-oh, here we go again. I'm just dehydrated. And finally, my mom, who was like a health education teacher, she freaked out. She thought I was bleeding to death. She didn't know why my pee was the color of Coca-Cola. Took me to the pediatrician, and he said, oh, don't worry about it. Your body is just producing too much lactic acid. You need to drink a lot of fluids and it'll go away. So for my whole life, all through college, having children, working, night shift, the whole bit, it wasn't until I was 39 years old that it happened and I ended up in the hospital. My CPK level was 44,000. They thought I was a drug addict. They thought I was bit by a rattlesnake. They thought I was a crackhead. I mean, they asked me all these things, and I'm like, dude, this happens like all the time to me. I've had this my whole life. And they're like, oh, we need to admit you. They did a muscle biopsy eventually, and I got the diagnosis of CPT deficiency. When I had the rhabdo, that hospital stay with the levels of 44,000, I was so weak after I got out of the hospital, I thought I would never be able to take care of my children. I thought I would never be able to work again. I was so scared. Nobody could tell me what my future would be like. Nobody could tell me if this was life or death. Nobody could tell me anything. It was so scary. But I'm happy to report that I'm 66. I just retired. I walk 10,000 steps a day, which is a friggin' miracle, because I used to not be able to walk 150 steps. And what did I do? I just decided this was not going to get me. I am more powerful than an FOD. I am going to exercise a little bit every day. And I went to this little park near my house, and I started out, like Katie said, one flip around the pond, next month, 2, then 6, then 8. And when I started realizing that, like, as long as I brought something to drink, and maybe if I had an apple with me, and maybe I used to have Quest bars or whatever in those days, but I was so afraid that I was going to lock up somewhere in that park. So I wouldn't go far. Whenever it would happen, I wouldn't be that far from my car. So I would go around the lake, around the lake, around the lake, around the lake. And now it's like a miracle. I don't get it. I mean, I still have CPT deficiency, but I don't have that pain that I used to have. But if I get a viral infection, like when I had COVID, it was bad news. Like I was just on the verge of rhabdo the whole time. And when I say rhabdo, it's that severe pain. I can't sit on the toilet. I can't walk. I can't go upstairs. I can't move. And then my pee is black. So that's, to me, the telltale sign of rhabdo. So if somebody says rhabdo to me, I say, is your urine Coca-Cola color? That's the telltale sign. And my levels sometimes go sky high, but I do exactly what you guys say. I drink the Gatorade. I eat the high carb food. I stop all exercise. And eventually a few days later, I'm okay. So that's my story. So don't give up. And I don't feel the medical professionals know what the hell is going on. I never had anybody ever offer me physical therapy. So I think this is amazing. Nobody ever even encouraged me to go to physical therapy to build my leg muscles back up. I did it myself. But it was a long time ago. So hopefully things are a little better now. That's encouraging.
I am hoping that things get better. Like I said, the old school approach was definitely just, okay, don't touch you, stay in bed until you feel better. And definitely the newer generation doctors, I'm married to one, my husband is in his last year of residency. I feel like their mindset has been changing where they realize, okay, actually the most conservative thing that we can do to help you get better is to send you to therapy, to have you start moving and start little by little doing what you can do. So I am so sorry that they didn't have anything to offer you for the longest time. I hope that this can help us move forward. And like I said, please feel free to give me any feedback that you like. It's very much a living document. It's not anywhere near the final stage. So it can
I've even had neurologists who have, I had a great neurologist. He was amazing, but he went down to a hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. He was an expert in muscular dystrophy and a lot of these fatty oxidation disorders, and I trusted him with my life. Then he left, and the guy we have now, I don't even think he understands what I've got, because I'll explain my story to him when I'm not feeling well. And he's like, would you mind if I brought a few students in here and they heard your story? And I'm like, I don't mind, but can you help me? No. So I just feel like I have to be my own advocate, and I have to stay healthy mentally, physically, spiritually, every way. And it's so scary. It's so scary to have something that people don't understand, you know, and we have to support each other too. And I'm glad you're doing this. Very helpful.
I think it's also, it really sucks to, like, sorry, you're in that position. I just got a new consultant in January, and I'm sorry, I don't know that much about CPT too, but when we get rhabdo or symptoms, we have to go in for dextrose 10%. So I'm not sure if that's the IV you get as well. But my new consultant doesn't believe in dextrose 10%. He says only D20 works. So his method is just like completely fluid overloading people. Like I won't even go there, but like it does suck when the person who's meant to be your advocate, the metabolic person, doesn't understand. And I similarly also had an experience where he wouldn't speak to me unless 7 people were in the room with him, you know, like these people that want the students around them to so they can feel kind of important. I think usually they do it just to try to make the students believe that they know about the disease when really they just don't know about the disease. But sorry, Pam, I just had one thing. Sorry, it might be in the layout, but I think it might be useful just to put in a clause that it's an obvious one, but just like that FODs can have like chronic relapses into rhabdo. And so maybe just like a line to kind of encourage practitioners that like it can sometimes be the case where, you know, they can start to have symptoms again, and in that case you can stop. And sometimes it can be like it can be very slow progress, because sometimes the exertion element of the rehab, even if it's very gentle, might push them back in. So in that case you just back off again. So that maybe a line, just a brief line added in might be helpful, because say like with Alex and me, like we could we could actually be set off on a bad day with even mild movement. And then there was one more thing. There were like, this might already say it, but like, did I see it right that the first page at the very start says after 72 hours?
Yes. So like I said, I imagined this was the initial monitoring while you're in the hospital. So there is a period of rest with that CK monitoring while you're just completing stretches and just really gentle range of motion. After that, I tried to stay away from giving defined time limits because everyone's recovery is a little different and everyone's finish line is a little different. In the later stages of the protocol, I talk about like plyometric and really like intense strength building exercises. That may not be the finish line for everyone. If you're older and you're working and you have children, maybe getting to the stage of being able to take steps and lift your child, maybe that's the finish line and you're not looking to go into like volleyball or hockey or whatever your sport might be.
Yeah, no, I think it's important because I'm thinking of the 72 hours because for me that would be presuming I'm in on the right treatment, my CKs would peak by day three, usually on day three, and then it kind of crashes down. So I liked that it was 3 days because a lot of metabolic consultants or physicians would be kind of on that same page where if you get the treatment quickly, it can, CKs can peak at 3 days. I'm not meeting myself. And then I think that was all I was thinking of. Yeah. And then just another line that, it might be nice to add in just like a little bit somewhere about how, you know, again, someone was saying that it was hard to like they should just go upstairs and that kind of thing. So like, again, kind of going back to the sarcopenia of chronic diseases and similar to sarcopenia of elderly, like after a rhabdo event, like your basic like daily functioning, like your activities of daily life are really, really badly affected. So it might be nice to like just put in like a line, again, just caution that you might be dealing with a lot of people who just have no frame of reference for this. And they don't really understand that we're dealing with like a life of rhabdo on and off. And so it might just be nice to put in a line that, you know, to maybe try, you can kind of frame it as like, or like encourage the patient that limitations in activities of daily life might be impaired for a couple of months and that kind of thing. But it might also be nice to use that as a reminder to a physical therapist or a practitioner who's using the guidelines, just to remind them as well, just because, you know, we might sometimes, you can get people who are a bit overzealous, you know. Those were the two things I just wanted to say before I forgot.
I know. On that note, Pamela, I'm looking at this. I'm curious, like it says 1 to 3 sets of 10 to 15 reps, like, because you mentioned, you know, the importance of like the repetitive repetitions being an issue. Like, do you think it's better for them to do alternating sets, or does that matter because you're saying it's just 10 to 15 or how do you know that like 10 to 15 is not too much, like right after rhabdo? Is it just like how?
So those numbers come from the American College of Sports Medicine. They did a very long 30-year study on different strength building techniques. And this is what I took from, it was carried over in a few different protocols. To be honest, we might not truly know until we test it out. If I saw someone, my goal, their very first session, like if we were entering this stage two, would be honestly just the one set of trying to get that 10 to 15 reps and then be done with that muscle group, be done with that body part, moving on to somewhere else. I would only do one set of exercises per body set in this stage. I think later on, I think I aimed for stage 5. Where we're adding a few more exercises per body area. Really at first, you just want to limit the load on specific muscle groups until they can tolerate it. I would say my initial thought, if I was seeing someone, would be to gradually build them up to tolerate that three sets. And once they're able to, think about progressing them onto the next stage. I did throw in quite a few references to the Borg scale, which I know most people aren't very familiar with, and I've been debating if it's better to use target heart rate ranges. Essentially, there are similar things. The Borg scale measures your rate of perceived exertion, and then it lines up with target heart rate zones. So many of us have wearables now. One question I had is it better just to include the Borg scale in this protocol and just have it as an easy reference, or to have those heart rate ranges? And I can pull up what the Borg scale looks like.
I think you should keep it, because I think a lot of my medical providers, even during rhabdo, is a very big, even if it's, you know, subjective to where I'm at in my rhabdo pain scale, you know, if something I'm doing in PT is triggering that rhabdo pain to go up, you know, that would definitely indicate something for them.
I'm just wondering with the heart rate, two things. One is just, is there any risk with monitoring heart rate, then it might cause a little bit of extra, I'm particularly thinking in younger FODs, is there any risk of a bit of anxiety if they have a history or a fear of developing heart issues? Like, is there any risk that they might start to overanalyze or overly focus on heart rate? And also, if they are at risk of, because you could argue it either way, if they are at risk of developing abnormalities in their heart rhythm, is it possible that some people are just living with that, and then maybe it could be like a false trigger that something's wrong? Or could it be like it's a bit of a, I'm not sure how I feel about the heart rate. I mean, like, I think I probably, if I was rehabbing, I probably would have not wanted too many things to focus on. I think probably the most valuable thing is subjective feelings of exertion, to be honest.
That's something that I was considering too, because as we age, our heart rate tends to vary. It also varies with our level of fitness and with gender and a few other background factors as well. So while we can have set ranges that we're targeting for, honestly, they correlate really well with the Borg scale, and it's pretty standardized. So that's why I ultimately went with that, because I didn't want people necessarily focusing so much on wearables and having anxiety trigger into it and affecting the numbers that they might be feeling. But I'm open to it. I'm open to maybe having both as an option. If obviously I have a wearable and I use it when I exercise to see what zone I might be in. I'm not sure if more information is necessarily helpful here, or if it's just more information that muddies the waters.
I have a question.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Fred Jacobo, and I have CPT too. And I was wondering if this relates to, I had an operation on my hand. I have arthritis in my hand, and I had the CMC joint was operated on, and over a year ago. And I never really recovered from the operation. And I'm wondering if other people have had similar operations and what their recovery from that is like.
Do Do you mean just the area itself hasn't recovered, or do you mean you decompensated metabolically and you haven't recovered from the surgery in terms of your energy?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I do exercise, I swim, I ride my bicycle, but my hand itself, it was supposed to take away the pain in my thumb, the arthritic pain in my thumb, and I still have a lot of pain in my hand. And we keep going back and exploring it. So I was just wondering if anybody else had experience like that, where they had an isolated surgery, and what amount of time it took for that to heal.
Like, I've had a lot of isolated surgeries, and I've had a lot of big surgeries. Like, I've had a couple of GI surgeries and that kind of thing, but not with arthritis. I think that's kind of a tough one, because it's kind of it's immune mediated. So it could be, I think probably your best bet might be just to ask for different meds, or maybe because they tried steroids or anything like that for you.
Well, we doctor keeps on going back. I've taken an MRI. He's trying to figure out, you know, what's wrong with it. And I'm pretty much at this point, I don't know what I'm going to do. I use my hands a lot. I do a lot of mechanical things, very handy around the house. So it kind of puts a damper on that. You learn to lose when you're right-handed, and that happens, you learn to use your left hand pretty fast. But still, you know, like if you got it, you grab a jar and you try to open it. So I didn't think about it for a long time, but I was wondering if the CPT2 had anything to do with the operation and the hand healing. That's all. I just want to sort of throw that out there.
It's possible that it may factor in. I had one case study that I came across where a patient had gluteal compartment syndrome. They had a FAOD, and with the positioning that they were in, essentially they had an injury to an area in their bottom, and how they were positioned for the surgery, it was so long and it was dependent, meaning that it was lower than the rest of their body. So a lot of blood pooled that area. They actually ended up having to go into rehab and having a pretty extensive stay of physical therapy to help recover from it. So they did experience some delayed healing. I will be completely honest with you and tell you that I'm not the biggest fan of the CMC joint. That's my own just bias. I'm not a hand specialist, but some of the patients that I've seen, I don't personally feel like the outcomes are the best for that surgery. Did they give you an implant, or did they just remove the joint completely?
They did put in an implant. They put in something between the two bones, the thumb and the first finger. Yeah. A hinge.
Do you feel like it's more that you don't have the full movement that you want, or your grasp isn't the same, or it's more still a lot of pain?
It's just out of a lot of pain. I noticed that, for instance, I play the piano, so like I don't have the same span. I can't play like a C with my thumb and my pinky. It doesn't reach that far anymore. But, you know, so I know that changed. I could move my thumb. I could do in all different positions. It's just, I still get a lot of pain in it when I'm sitting down and doing and work. And I just kind of, the best I can do, I kind of ignore it. But it's there. It bothers me.
It can definitely depend on how they tethered the tendon, if they did that at all. What that is essentially you have to make little anchors to keep the replacement part in place. So depending on how they put it in and how they anchored it in, that could have reduced your span to reach on the piano. Some initial thoughts that I have are, if they haven't given you any yet, cortisone injections might be a good option for the pain. You might still have some inflammation that's trapped in that area because it's pretty small. And if you're not getting the full movement that you used to have, it's very difficult for that swelling to get out of that area. and that can help calm it down a little bit. If you have had cortisone injections, in all honesty, I might recommend that you pursue acupuncture or, depending on your state, dry needling. So acupuncture and dry needling are essentially the same things. One follows Eastern traditional Chinese medicine. Dry needling is something physical therapists can do, and it is more of a Western medicine approach. The downside is, in the States, it turned into a battle state by state for the right of physical therapists to do it. When I was in Texas, that was something that we were able to do. Now that I'm in New York, the acupuncturists won that fight. They said that it would take away livelihood from them if we were able to do it. So I'm not able to do it in this state. But what happens is the needle gets deeper into the muscle than like a traditional massage, and it can just stimulate some micro damage to the area that triggers the healing process. If you do pursue acupuncture, I would look for an acupuncturist who uses electrical stimulation with the needles that they use. So they would just have like a little TENS unit that sends a trigger of electricity through the needle. The research has told us that it gives you more benefit faster if you do that approach, as opposed to the more traditional acupuncture technique, which might go a little shallower.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the information. It's very good. I did have additional shots, and it really hasn't helped. So, but thank you for information about the acupuncture.
Of course. Okay. Thank you. I would say I don't know how many shots you've had. I have found that it can take up to maybe 4 injections for people to actually see a benefit, just because the area is so small and they have to hit right on it for you to have a clinically significant change. But like I said, depending on your state, where are you living? Do you know if...
I live in New York on Long Island.
Okay, so you would probably have to see someone, an acupuncturist instead of a physical therapist then.
Right, okay, thank you.
Okay, so I think we got to everyone who had raised their hands to share. If anyone else has a story they'd like to share, just let me know. Otherwise, I think I'll pull up the protocol again just so that you can all see it. I did make a template survey to send out to you all. I think we addressed most of the things that were in it. Let me see, I can pull that up now. So I think a lot of these questions we went over.
Pamela, would it be helpful if we sent this survey out and to see if anybody felt like there was anything that could be added or that they see missing? Would that be helpful?
I think that would be a good idea. So what I anticipate happening from here is I'd like to take the feedback that you've given me, and I plan on updating the protocol. At the end of this month, I'm planning on presenting the protocol as it is at the Inform conference. And from there, I'm hoping to work with Dr. Vakli. I moved to Pittsburgh in about a year from now. Hopefully we can set up an area in his lab where we can test out the protocol and try to work on getting it published, just to see what kind of data that we can get. Unfortunately, part of that process would involve surveys like this one, just seeing what people's experiences are with rhabdo, getting data from before, during, and after, just to see how it works, what issues there are with it. So we're very early on in the process, but that's at least where we are right now. We're in the we're still shaping this phase, and I'm just starting to share it with people. And yes, Becky, you had something that you wanted to share.
I have another question. It's Fred Jacobos.
Yes, go ahead.
This is Fred. Do you want me to speak?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to say something. So a lot of people say they did this, they had that, they have rhabdo. But I think it's also important to distinguish between muscle pain and weakness, and that you recover from that in a couple of days, versus rhabdo, where you actually have Coca-Cola colored urine.
Yes.
And of course, high CK. So in other words, like we'll speak to a lot of people on our Facebook group, and they'll say, oh, I had rhabdo, so I stayed home and I drank a lot of Gatorade and I'm eating a lot of food and I'm feeling better. And then we'll have other people that say, I had rhabdo, I was in the hospital, I had CK of 40,000. But, you know, what they'll both say, I just had a rhabdo event.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just like a little bit different for everyone. Like I've had CKs of 10,000, like say, or 9,000, for example. And like that meets the criteria for rhabdo because of the CKs. But I've only had the dark urine once, and I've been hospitalized for rhabdo technically, I think 3 times. But like for me, like the first, it would actually be more like, if you were to count up the different times I've been hospitalized, it would be more typical for me to actually have the urinary retention rather than like the really dark urine. Like that only happened to me when the CKs were like really, 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 really high. So I think it's also just possible that people are kind of having rhabdo, but they're just not having the dark urine.
So technically when you get dark urine, that's myoglobinuria. Mm-hmm. which is a stage of rhabdo, right? Because the muscles break down in the myoglobin, the pigment is what comes out of the muscle, and that's what you eventually see in your urine. Maybe we have to start distinguishing between rhabdo and rhabdo with myoglobinuria.
Yeah, I think they do that, Pam, you know more than me, but like, do they do that in the literature anyway, where you can have rhabdo, but one of the symptoms of rhabdo is myoglobinuria. So not everyone will have it.
So to get the diagnosis, if you're admitted to the hospital, you'll have to have 3 symptoms. You'll have to have muscle pain, you'll have to have myoglobinuria, and you'll also have to have the elevated CK levels. Now, it is completely possible to have rhabdo but not have all of those conditions met. This will just be what gets you that diagnosis in your chart as having rhabdo. So something to keep in mind is if you are suspecting that you're going into an episode of rhabdo, and you know that in the past that you haven't had always that consistent Coca-Cola urine, is to just tell them up front, this is my medical history, this is my past experience with rhabdo, I don't have this color urine yet, but this is what is pending. The other thing to keep in mind is that kind of differentiation between, like, is it rhabdo or is it DOMS, which is delayed onset muscle soreness, which can present really similarly. Where DOMS, you don't have that Coca-Cola colored urine, rhabdomyolysis, you do. Other than that, they overlap quite a bit. So really generally, I always prefer the most conservative approach, where if you are suspecting that you're having rhabdo, absolutely go and get checked out. The first step before that, if you're assessing yourself and you're like, well, I don't know, is test out your movement. If you're having pain at rest, I'm more suspicious that it's rhabdo versus, say, you had a workout a few days ago and you did a bunch of lunges and you're like, okay, yeah, now when I squat down and I pick up something off the floor, my legs are hurting. I'm more suspicious that this is DOMS as opposed to rhabdo. But like I said, most conservative approach, if you're suspecting it, please go get checked out.
I think Becky was able to fix her computer. She had to get on and then off. So I think she's probably ready to talk now.
Yes, I apologize for that. I got disconnected. I just have a question. So I have a 15-year-old with CPT2, and I have never heard a word about physical therapy or anything at all. They basically send him home from the hospital and tell him he can go right back to soccer. So he will run, you know, 5, 6, 7 miles a day after getting out of the hospital. But he's had 7 hospital stays this summer, so we need to change something. So I'm just wondering, if we were to follow this protocol, he's usually done with the pain by the time he gets out of the ER and into the room. So even though his CK is over 100,000, he still feels fine within a couple hours. So would you follow this same protocol, or would you skip any steps and move him forward with no pain?
On his very first day, this is day 2 or 3, I might bump him up to just some ADLs. So that's activities of daily living, which would just be seeing how he walks around and being really conservative with it. So that kind of edges into the border of that phase 2. My most conservative approach would be really to wait those first few days and then try to gradually bump him up. I do advise that if he needs those bumpers put in place, requesting on discharge some outpatient physical therapy. One of my other specialties is concussion, and I consider it a specialty of mine that I am a professional bumper for teenagers that want to get back to sport after they've damaged their brains and need to be told, no, you can't do that yet. So that's something that I've become very good at, I think, just gradually progressing that activity, because you can definitely do too much too fast, both with this and with concussion.
Okay, thank you very much.
Of course. I think we have someone else again.
Robin, you can go ahead. We see your hand raised.
Okay. My story is just kind of like everybody else's with a little twist. But when I was 14, I had my first major rhabdo event, and it was really, really fast. Like, I woke up, got in the shower, and by the time I got out of the shower 15 minutes later, I could barely lift my legs to get out of the shower. And I got dressed, went back to my room, and literally tipped over onto my bed and waited for somebody to wake up. And I didn't move, really, I mean, just barely moving, for a week. And when my parents finally got me to the doctor and the doctor said, we need to take blood, I had kidney failure. So I was life flighted to University of Denver Hospital and put on dialysis. They were trying to figure out everything. You know, why is this happening? They looked at hantavirus. They looked at everything. So my diagnosis was rhabdomyolysis with acute kidney failure due to influenza A. So I know that's my trigger, but I went from age 14 to 46 with no diagnosis. They missed it in the hospital. And I know they missed it because it's in my chart that they looked at it and said, we're not going to go with that diagnosis of CPT2 because there hasn't been any other occurrences. But looking back in my childhood, I can pick out a few things where it was there. But I also didn't have Coca-Cola colored urine. I had very, very bright red urine. So I've never had really dark urine, just the bright red. And I went through my life, they said this should never happen again. It was just a fluke. And so I went through most of my life thinking that. But 20 years ago, my brother, one of my 4 brothers, had the same thing happen. And he was hospitalized, almost on dialysis. He didn't quite lose his kidney function. They caught it in time. And he was diagnosed with CPT2. So for 20 years, I've gone to doctors and said, I'm thought to have had this. His doctors requested my records and said, she probably has this, but no doctors would listen to me and test me for anything until 2 years ago. And that's when I was diagnosed. So I've kind of just gone through life. Yeah, I'm kind of sore. It's probably this. I better eat some carbs. And that's it. So for 2 years now, I've luckily had, you know, doctors that know what they're doing and the support of the Facebook group, our CPT group. They're all great. And so that's where I'm at. And I'm just trying to get to the point of being better. And I'm not quite there yet. So.
I am very sorry. It's very frustrating to feel like you aren't being listened to, especially by medical professionals. And it's difficult because I think we're all trained to really listen to medical professionals and take them at their word as, okay, you went through all this education, so you know best and you're taking care of me. And I will say, having been on both sides of the medical system, I think for the most part, that's true. I don't think I've ever met someone who goes into this profession and just doesn't want to try to make someone's life better. But the sad truth is that there are some really great ones. And then there are some that, like, we're all human. There are some that take on more than they maybe should and should acknowledge a little more when they don't know something. Something I try to always tell patients is, you absolutely have the right to fire your medical professional. I've been fired as a physical therapist where I've had patients say, I don't think we drive well. I work in pediatrics, so I'm very up on this level. And sometimes people need someone very, very, very flat. So finding someone who works with you and listens with you is very important.
Yeah. I have fired a few now, but I'm good where I'm at. So.
So what are you all thinking at this point? I know I think Stephanie ran past the estimated end time. Would it be helpful to have me pull up the protocol for us all just to take a look at together? Are people feeling very tired, and would you like it in an email form? What do you think? I see email.
I would say email too, and sorry for sneezing. I tried to turn off the mic. Sneeze into everyone. I think email is good. Sorry, it's like 2 a.m. here, so I'll go soon, but happy to review it all completely in an email.
Okay, so Stephanie, what I might do is send the document to you, because then you can share it a little more broadly than I can, and then you could maybe attach my private email with that. I think that just is easiest, since I will only stay at Upstate for like maybe half a year or so. That way, if you guys get used to that contact for me, it just carries forward when I move to Pittsburgh.
So will you attach, will you send me both the protocol and the survey to attach, Pamela?
I can do that.
Okay. I'm going to copy this other thing. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight and sharing your stories and engaging in conversation around this important topic. We really, really appreciate you guys coming here. And I know that you have Pamela's email address. I'm going to repost it in the bottom in case you came in a little bit later. But I will send you guys, I wrote down everybody's name that's here. I should have your email address from when you signed up for Zoom. But if you don't hear from me, sorry, Harry, you can contact me at sharry@mitoaction.org. So if you don't know me, if this is your first time seeing me and your email address is not something like robinanderson@gmail or something like that, then I'm going to be able to easily decipher. Please don't hesitate to reach out to me personally if you don't receive something from me, because it probably means I wasn't able to decipher what your email address was. So, I think that's about it. So we really, really appreciate everybody coming tonight, and feel free to email us if you have any more questions.
Yes. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for sharing your stories and helping me out. I do this again in a few nights. So if you have any feedback at all about how this ran, the length of time we spent on different areas, just let us know. Mostly me, because Stephanie's awesome on her own.
Awesome. Have a good night.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night from Long Island.